Hello and welcome to the sixth segment of Sahara Universal Network's special program titled Dawn of Awakening. My name is Vahid Tahami. Now, last week we examined some of the roles different organizations and key figures played in helping bring about the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. In today's segment, we are going to look at how various Western countries reacted to it.
To news of the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution were mixed, ranging from disbelief to outright hostility. Such reactions were really not surprising. For the past 150 years, Western empires has discounted the sovereign rights of any Middle Eastern state. The prevalent belief among the empire builders was that the countries in the region were little more than colonies to be exploited. However, news of the victory of the Islamic Revolution especially irritated the United States, which had long considered Iran its personal property. Therefore, from the onset, Washington began to plan ways to unset Tehran's government and regain control of the country.
Islamic thinkers have also worked in these areas. But the Western intellectuals have longer records in presenting different and numerous theories in this regard. Politically speaking, I should like to point out three important aspects, one being ideological or legitimizing aspect. For example, theoreticians like Max Weber moot the tripartite classification of authority. It says, the legitimate rule means that people abide by a political system or regime with content and willingness. It may be a traditional or charismatic legitimacy. It is also likely to be a legal, rational one, or in fact in the form of bureaucratic and modern systems. Apart from different types of legitimate dominations, there is an important discourse that a political regime may continue life so long as it depends on a source of legitimization. It might be traditional. In history, people witnessed kings and rulers whom they accepted by tradition. After all, they needed rulers or kings to administer their affairs, to bring them security and safeguard their homeland borders, or in other cases, improve their living conditions. If such legitimacy goes under question, and the regime does not enjoy an ideology for itself based on which people are convinced to comply with the rule, it would naturally face challenges. It would face crises and is likely to eventually fall. This is an important aspect which gives legitimacy to a political system. Every political system has to rely on a pillar of legitimacy based on which it would build up its foundation.
In July 1980, U.S. National Security Advisors Zbigniew Brzezinski met with Jordan's King Hussein in Amman to discuss detailed plans. Now, the plans called for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to sponsor a coup in Iran against the country's new leader, Imam Khomeini. King Hussein was Saddam's closest confidant in the Arab world and served as an intermediary during the planning. The Iraqi invasion of Iran would be launched under the pretext of a call for aid from anti-revolutionary Iranian officers plotting their own uprising on July 9th, 1980. Now, the operation's code name was Noje, after the Shahrokh Noje Air Base in Hamadan. The group of rebellious Iranian officers had been organized by the last Iranian prime minister under the Shah, Shapur Bakhtiar, who had fled to France when Imam Khomeini took power. However, Imam Khomeini learned about the planned coup before it took place and was able to prevent it. Therefore, it was decided that Saddam should invade Iran anyway, albeit without the help of the Iranian proxy officers. The invasion, which took place on September 22, 1980, marked the beginning of the Iraq-Iran War. At around the same time, virtually all of the Western mainstream media launched a gigantic smear campaign against Iran, a propaganda war that has, through the years, only increased in intensity. This media war, along with arms sanctions and the long-lasting war with Iraq, proved added burdens to the young Islamic Republic. However, none of these measures managed to accomplish their purpose, which was to destroy it.
Mrs. Farah Pahlavi, in her book, An Orphan Girl, quoted the Shah as having said that during the Arab oil embargo in 1967, he returned on Iran's oil tap for the West and Israel. He would not allow the industry of the Occident to grind to a halt, even at the risk of jeopardizing Iran's relations with the Arab world. In order to secure the Persian Gulf during the Zofad War and guarantee the safe passage of oil to America, Japan, and Europe, he sent Iranian soldiers to quell the leftist riots. He cracked down on religious forces and leftists to preserve the West. And he even gave the top U.S. commander in South Vietnam Iranian-owned fighter planes. The Shah went on to say that he accepted whatever they wanted and obeyed their orders, both regionally and abroad. He allocated a yearly budget of $1 billion for buying American weapons and gave million-dollar endowments to various U.S. training and social institutions. Shah so fully confessed to his dependency on the regime that stymied his own country. The West was evidently not happy with the silence of such a regime, as mentioned by him and as Mrs. Pahlavi was quoted. The Pahlavi regime had been a dedicated servant of the West and an implementer of the regional and trans-regional instructions of Americans and foreigners. As a result, the whole West, even if divided on any subject, got united against the Islamic Revolution. They never welcomed the Islamic Revolution and never showed a good attitude to it.
How had Western empires viewed Middle Eastern states for the past 150 years? It was soon obvious that opposition to Iran's Islamic Revolution was not limited to a few Western empires. Some Middle Eastern heads of state were opposed as well, which was illustrated by Saddam's attack. The leaders of Iraq, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf states were also distressed by the victory of the Islamic Revolution. They were afraid that the revolution might spill over into their own countries, and they feared for the safety of their thrones. Moreover, Iran was calling for support to be given to oppressed people throughout the world, which naturally alienated corrupt rulers. Iran declared that it was neither East nor West and was opposed to both American and Soviet policies to master the world. Thus, when Saddam invaded Iran, he received backing from not only the two superpowers, but from a number of Arab monarchies as well. They considered them little more than colonies to be exploited.
Look, the question is that Iranian revolution was not a class revolution, was not a political parties revolution, was not intellectual revolution. It was the revolution of masses. When we're talking about the masses, means that all the people participated, with the leadership of religious clergies, with the ulama, although we cannot really deny that intellectuals were also participated. Some other political parties who were either hidden or were open, they also participated, but they did not have any role in running the revolution, in contributing to the mass mobilization. Mass mobilization were done by the leaders, especially with Imam Khomeini, who was one of the Maroje-e-Taqlid, and therefore, if you want to still compare it with other revolutions, Iranian revolution was a cultural.
What was the code name of the attempted coup to overthrow Imam Khomeini?
The people's uprising in Iran was really a great shock for foreign powers, for foreigners who have had some kind of interest in Iran. It is interesting that none of them could anticipate or predict that such a revolution could occur. About 4 months before the success of the revolution, in February 1979, DIA and CIA, the two intelligence agencies of the United States, gave a report in which they said that for 10 years from now, the Pahlavi dynasty is in power. Not only Iran is not in a revolutionary stage, but Iran is not in a pre-revolutionary stage. Hua Kufeng, the president of the PRC, People's Republic of China, came to Iran 3 months before the revolution and contributing to the Shah to stay in power. And even the Soviet Union did not really help. On the other hand, with regard to the merit of the revolution, which was Islamic Republic, none of them really let such a revolution succeed.
Noje.
Saddam's venture into Iran ultimately ended in failure. Iran was much stronger and better organized than the Iraqi dictator had thought. In fact, the invasion by Iraq actually served to strengthen the new republic. Iranians rallied behind their leader and government in the face of the national threat and overwhelming tragedy. The war and their shared grief bonded them together as never before. The same year that Saddam invaded, a new Iranian constitution was passed in a referendum by an overwhelming majority. This, more than anything else, showed the world that the Iranian people backed the new government. Nevertheless, the United States and other Western nations never stopped trying to derail the Islamic Republic.
As was mentioned earlier, the United States and other Western countries launched a massive media war against the Islamic Republic, a war that is still being waged and has in recent months intensified. Moreover, the United States initiated a number of economic measures in an effort to cripple the Iranian economy. In 1979, after the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, the United States froze about $12 billion in Iranian assets, including bank deposits, gold, and other properties. According to U.S. officials, most of these were released in 1981. However, Iranian officials say that $10 billion of those assets remain frozen.
Well, thank you for joining us for this sixth segment of The Dawn of Awakening. Be sure and tune in next week at the same time and place when we will examine some of the achievements of Iran's Islamic Revolution.
And the new constitution contained both short-term and long-term goals. Therefore, the leaders were given the responsibility of fulfilling the will of the people, which included looking after the welfare and happiness of the society.